It's Central Time. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. The heart and our understanding of it has evolved a lot over time. How the heart developed in living organisms and how it influenced our culture is the subject of a new book. Bill Schutt is an emeritus professor of biology at Long Island University and a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History. He's the author of Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. He spoke with WPR host J. Carlisle Larson last month.
Let's actually take a moment and demystify the heart, which has a long storied history, but at its most basic, knowing what we know now, what is it?
Yeah, I'll give you a bit of background information first. If you're really, really tiny and you do, whether you're small or whether you're large, you need certain substances. You need to be able to take nutrients into your body and get or sell and get rid of waste products. You also need, for the most part, oxygen, and you've got to get rid of carbon dioxide, which is a byproduct of a lot of the chemical reactions that take place in the body or in the cell. And so if you're really small, you don't need a mechanism for that to occur, other than the fact that these materials will diffuse across your outer membrane, and they'll move from a high concentration on the outside of you if you happen to be sitting in water, and they'll move in across your cell membrane. And by the same token, the stuff that builds up to high concentrations like toxins inside your body or your cell will move out. And this happens by diffusion, which is this process of moving it with a concentration gradient. You're going from a high concentration to a low concentration. So if that's all well and good if you're small, but if you're large, that doesn't work if you're made up of hundreds or thousands of cell layers thick. You can't get material to move efficiently by diffusion. So what evolved probably half a billion years ago were methods that allowed materials to be moved around inside these organisms. And this, it was probably water at first. And then I believe at a certain point, you started to move what we would call blood. If you're talking about insects or some invertebrates, it would be called hemolymph. And it's a way to enable the movement of material within the body efficiently. So really what the heart does, and there are hearts of every size and shape, and you know, there are probably some specialists who would not consider some of these structures to be hearts because they don't check off all of the criteria that they might include in looking at a human heart, for example. But they're muscular pumps. If you picture a tube that is composed of muscle cells that run around in the opposite direction from the length of the tube, and when those contract, it's kind of like squeezing on a water balloon that's full of water. And so when you do that, your fingers that are squeezing on that balloon, those are the muscle fibers. And when they contract, you can envision sending that liquid a distance. And that's really how some of the first hearts likely worked. And then they became more complex over millions and millions of years. Many of them, I mean, they're all efficient, though. There's this tendency that we have to think that the organ, whatever it happens to be in humans, that's the ultimate, the best. It's not necessarily so. These other structures do just as well. They do the job that, you know, that they evolved to do. And they do it efficiently, whether you're talking about an insect with something that you might not consider to be a heart or, you know, a four-chambered heart in a human.
That's really fascinating. We're talking to Bill Schutt right now. He's an emeritus professor of biology at Long Island University Post and a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History. He's an author, and his latest book is Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. Now, Bill, we have taken a very quick, very fast overview of what the heart is and how it differs in different species, but let's look at the history of the heart, because you write in your book that it's better to judge our ancestors by what they got right as opposed to what they got wrong. So let's just take a really quick look there. What did they get right?
Well, they knew that the heart was important, but unfortunately, and I really am not trying to knock the physicians of in ancient times, but when the ancient Egyptians looked at the heart, and you know, they could tell that it was extremely important because it would, you know, living things moved, the heart moved, and when you stimulated an individual, it responded, and when you stimulated the heart, it responded. When you, you know, if you have strong emotions, for example, they would notice that the heart beat would increase, and so they were really the first to come up with this idea of cardiocentrism, which is that the heart is really the seat of what we would consider to be the soul, also intelligence and emotions. And they didn't think much of the brain. And when the and they were expert medical people for their time. And a lot of what they learned and what they followed was picked up by the Greeks, who admired the medical capability of the Egyptians. But they also picked up, the ancient Greeks also picked up on this idea of the heart being the center of things as far as the soul and intelligence and emotion. And so from there, and we're talking about some of the major philosophers and medical people back then, you know, Aristotle and Hippocrates. And so that was then picked up by the Romans. And at the same time, you had artists that were jumping on the bandwagon, whether they were painters or they were poets or they were writers, with this idea that the heart is central to things like emotion and the soul and intellect. Now, from a medical perspective, a lot of times they were sort of hamstrung because they couldn't do dissections on human bodies. Their cultures did not allow it. And so, people like Galen, who was a Roman surgeon, he wrote 3 million words on the things that he learned about the body, but he was using animals that weren't human. So a lot of what he got was wrong. And the unfortunate thing is that it was all picked up and spread because of translations that took place of his work after the Roman Empire fell. Syrian translators who happened to be Christian translated his work, and the church in Europe picked up on that. It sounded pretty friendly, and they adopted Galen's teachings as being divinely inspired. So for the next 1500 years, it really put the kibosh on research, because you didn't have to do anything except read what Galen had written, and a lot of it was wrong. And so that became extremely problematic, and it really put medical fields way behind the eight ball for far, far longer than Galen was alive.
That's Bill Shutt, author of Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. He's speaking with WPR host J. Carlisle Larson. Another historical fact for you, it wasn't until the 17th century when William Harvey discovered how the heart pumped blood. More of that conversation's coming up right here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. Right now, we're learning about the history and evolution of the heart. Bill Shutt is the author of Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. He spoke with WPR host J. Carlisle Larson.
What's interesting about, as we've kind of gone through the history of the heart, is the impact that this history still has on us today in many ways. You hear someone say, oh, well, they lead with their heart, or they're hot-blooded. Can you talk a little bit about how these cultural touchstones still remain today?
Yeah, I think that this is clearly a remnant of this idea of cardiocentrism, which became so ingrained in mostly in Western thought, but also in Chinese traditional medicine, that placed such an emphasis on the heart with regard to things like emotion and intellect, and especially emotions that were, you know, strong emotions like love and hate. So I really think that this is a holdover from a time when artists went along with that. And so you got all of this phrasing, whether it's blue blood or hot blooded, that still remains in our literature and in our poetry and elsewhere.
So Bill,
yeah, just to add, you know, I think there's a realization for the most part that is just not the case anymore. And you now most people are sort of craniocentric. They believe that the brain is involved in intellect and things like generation of emotions and intelligence. And so there's certainly been a big change there, but the artists have been slow to change what has worked for them in the past and still works fine. I don't think anybody really takes it to heart anymore.
Enjoyed that.
Stay away from that.
So Bill, actually, let's stick with the brain and heart connection, since our bodies are a system. And even though historically there was a thought that, of course, we were cardiocentric, now we have this new thing where we think we are cranial centric. Can you talk, though, about the connection between the brain and the heart? And I bring that up because there's a Wisconsin connection there. Dr. Patrick McBride, he is professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah, Patrick McBride is an expert on cardiovascular risk factors. And so, so first of all, his middle name should be Moderation, because I think he believes that we'd all be in much better shape if we did all of these things that we're learning about, whether it's exercise or diet, if we did it all in moderation. For example, he loves the fact that people should take red wine. He believes that it's beneficial for the heart, as is dark beer. I celebrated when I heard that. I was like, all right, well, I've been doing it right. But, you know, he's somebody that believes that one of the major problems several of the major problems, first of all, is that, you know, if you're stressed, you are going to be subject to inflammation and to other types of parameters that are going to be damaging to somebody who has a heart condition or just came through a cardiac procedure. So he's really somebody who supports going to these post-operative courses, in a sense, where you're learning how to deal with this. You're not sitting home afraid. Your relatives are not. They might still be worrying about the fact that you could have the big one, but they're learning how to deal with it in a way that lowers stress. So that's a big thing for him. And, you know, he believes in things like whatever you do that lowers your stress, whether it's yoga or meditation, all of that is great. And you put that on top of a healthy diet, like a Mediterranean diet, for example, and then you can really lower your risk of having problems down the road. The unfortunate thing is that too few people follow up a cardiac procedure with this type of program afterwards. So he really stresses this post-cardiac work that needs to be done, that patients should partake of. But like I said, he's big into moderation. He really promotes statins to lower cholesterol levels, diet and exercise, all within moderation.
We're talking to Bill Shutt right now. He's an emeritus professor of biology at Long Island University Post and a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History. He's an author, and his latest book is Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. Let's look now at just some of the advances that have been made, because we have come leaps and bounds from Galen to today. What are some of the more interesting or just the things that have stood out to you as part of your research when it came to kind of novel approaches to treating the heart?
Sure. So I went to Boston. I went up to Harvard and I spoke to Dr. Harold Ott. And so Dr. Ott is concerned about the fact that there are, as many physicians are and researchers are, that a lot of folks are dying while they're waiting for transplants, and not necessarily heart transplants, but liver transplants and kidney transplants. And the reasons behind that are because you've got to have the right, you know, the correct tissue types. They've got to match. You've got to sometimes transport these organs across country, and you've got to do it quickly. And so what he's come up with is something that I thought was incredible. And that is, and rather than waiting for the correct, for a recipient, a potential organ recipient to wait on a waiting list, to see if the correct heart or organ would show up, he would take the heart of a cadaver and put it through a process that literally drains away all of the cellular components of the heart. So he hangs the organs and runs a type of a detergent through them. And what that does is takes out everything that your body would react to and respond to and reject, and leaves behind a framework made of connective tissue. So this thing looks like a heart. but it's sort of ghostly white looking. And then here's the idea. What he wants to then do, and he says that hopefully we can do this within 10 years, take a sample, a tissue sample, and we're not talking about an invasive biopsy. We're talking about skin cells from someone who's going to be this organ recipient. And you can take those skin cells called fibroblasts and stimulate them to become stem cells. This has been done. You take those stem cells and you can stimulate those stem cells to become cardiac muscle cells. And this has been done. So now what Ott wants to do now is take those cells that are grown from that recipient. So you're not going to reject them and literally seed this scaffold, this model that you have, and grow a heart that you can then transplant into this recipient. And so I was literally blown away when he went through this with me. And so that's certainly one. And I asked him, so what about the blood vessels that supply the heart? How do you duplicate those? And he sent me to a colleague of his at Worcester Polytech, and his name is Glenn Gaudette. And when I went into Dr. Gaudette's lab, he came out with a plate full of salad. And he said, what's this look like? I said, well, it looks like spinach leaves to me. He said, exactly. This is what we're using. And he showed me this procedure where they take a spinach leaf and you look at it, and certainly any other leaf that you see, there are veins on it. Now these are conduction systems, just like our arteries and veins. But they're really small, and it's very difficult to transplant small blood vessels, especially veins. So here he takes these spinach leaves, hangs them upside down, runs a substance through them, once again, a type of detergent that, in a sense, rinses away all of the cellular components, but leaves behind the structure of the vein. And he takes this and then seeds that with human blood vessel cells. And from there, he wants to take those and transplant them onto hearts. Because the problem is that if you're dealing with really small blood vessels, it's very difficult to move them around. So I was equally blown away by this gentleman who's building human blood vessels from the leaves of a spinach plant.
Now, I want to stick with that because there's a story in your book that is both equally fascinating, but also quite sad. And, you know, there have been a lot of advances in heart treatment. We still have a long way to go, as you just gave us an overview of this really fascinating new approach. But let's look at the story about Stephanie Faye Beauclair. Can we talk about her for a second?
Sure. So baby Faye was born with a defect in her heart, in which the left side of the heart, which is extremely important in pumping blood to the body, pretty much didn't work. And she was given a very, very few number of days to live. In fact, her mother was told, you can leave her here and she'll die. You can bring her home and she'll die. But there was really no alternative. This was a fatal heart disease. And so she was given an alternative by a physician by the name of Dr. Leonard Bailey. And Dr. Bailey had been working on transplants between species. For example, he would transplant baby baboon hearts into baby goats, and it was successful. Now, this was at a time when there were really no donor hearts for babies. There were transplants taking place with adults, but not for infants. There were literally no infant donor hearts. And so what he thought was he could do this type of a transplant where he would transplant the heart of a baboon into a human. So they used cyclosporin, in theory, to knock down the immune system so you wouldn't have a rejection response. So he ran this proposal by this young mother, and she accepted it. Now just to sort of put this into perspective, baby Faye almost died the night before the surgery. So there was no other alternative except to watch this poor baby die. So they did the surgery. His team had been trained, and they were sort of ready for this. And when they did it, it turned out initially, at least, to be a success. The heart started beating. The baby went from this sort of blue tint, because not getting enough oxygen, to looking much healthier. A couple of days later, the baby was feeding. It was smiling. And ultimately, though, baby Faye took a turn for the worse about 2 weeks after the surgery and died just about 3 weeks after the surgery had been performed. And they thought initially that it might have been a rejection of the heart, but it wasn't. It was this really unfortunate fact that the baby baboon that they used had a different blood type than baby Faye had. And it's not like they blew this. They made this huge mistake. They matched the donor and the recipient as much as they could. I believe they had six infant baboons to choose from, but they could not exactly match the blood type. So they thought they might be able to get by this because they thought baby Faye's immune system hadn't been developed enough to have that response to mismatched blood, or that they'd be able to knock the response down with cyclosporin, which depresses the immune system. It keeps your body from attacking a transplanted organ. But that didn't work. That was ultimately the reason. The body had an immune response and attacked itself, and this is why baby Faye died. So it was horrible, you know, tragic. But one of the things that happened there was that there was a tremendous amount of media coverage, and some of it good and some of it bad. But what ultimately came from this was that Dr. Bailey never had to use baboon hearts again, because now there was a public awareness that when babies died, when infants died, that you could donate their hearts. And that happened. So Dr. Bailey wound up performing 200 of these transplants in human babies successfully. So that was a huge positive that came from this horrible tragedy with baby Faye. And the other thing that took place was that the heart defect that baby Faye had, they have come up with a surgery, a three-part surgery that actually takes staged reconstruction, it's called, that takes place over a three-year period, that can reroute the circuitry of the heart. And it is an amazing, amazing surgery, so that they would never have to transplant baby Faye's heart today if she had, you know, been hospitalized nowadays.
Well, Bill, thank you so much. This has been really fascinating.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on your show.
That was author and zoologist Bill Shutt. He talked with J. Carlisle Larson about his latest book, Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. We're talking about the workplace and why, after decades of trainings and workshops and webinars, we still have a large gender imbalance when you look at the leadership ranks of many companies. Our next guest argues that the small, everyday biases can have large effects. Women's accomplishments are less often recognized, and they more often receive harsher punishment when they fail. So, she decided to try an experiment. She created a computer simulation of a company that included many of these biases that research has found that women deal with at work. And she found it doesn't take much bias for women to get behind. We're talking about unconscious bias today and how its real-world effects for women and minorities in the workplace. And we want to hear what you think. Have you experienced bias in the workplace? Are you a woman working in a male-dominated field? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us, Central Time WPR. We're speaking with science and culture journalist Jessica Nordell. Her new book is called The End of Bias, A Beginning, The Science and Practice of Overcoming Unconscious Bias. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Why did you want to study unconscious bias?
You know, it's a topic that I have been interested in for a really long time. I think my interest really started when I was kind of rudely awakened to its presence in my own career. I was a young journalist starting out in my 20s and trying to break into national magazines and national newspapers and not having a lot of luck. So one day I had a particular essay that I was trying to pitch to different publications and not getting a response. And it had a very narrow window of time that it was relevant for. So I kind of, in a moment of desperation, created a new email address and sent the essay out with the name JD Nordell instead of Jessica Nordell, thinking, well, maybe, you know, if I send it out under a man's name or an apparent man's name, I'll have a different response. And to my kind of shock, I didn't really think it was going to work, but it did. Like, the piece was accepted within hours, and it was the same piece as I had pitched under Jessica. And that really began my kind of rude awakening and fascination with the topic. And I've been studying it and writing about it ever since.
So to the same outlet, so the same pitch, the exact same story got approved when you submitted it under a different name, a more androgynous or masculine name?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
And so this book that you've written, you are trying to understand the science behind it. You wanted to get hard data on this kind of bias and how it actually affects women's careers. Tell us about you. So you made this simulation, this computer simulation, to try to model it. Tell us about how you did that.
Yeah, exactly. So when I was working on this project, I was really looking for, like, what the research says about how we tackle this problem, because there's copious research about the presence of unconscious or unintentional bias and discrimination sort of pervasively throughout so many different fields. We see it in healthcare, we see it in policing, we see it in the workplace, we see it in education. It's really all over the place. But what I wanted to do was, you know, in addition to look for evidence-based solutions, I wanted to understand kind of what the immensity of the problem was that we're dealing with. And if you look at gender bias, just narrowly, if you look at, for instance, gender bias in the workplace, one of the challenges is that when it's studied, it's typically studied kind of with, like, a snapshot approach. So studies will look at, for instance, they'll show sort of like the same resume with, like, a man's name and a woman's name, and then measure, you know, how much more likely someone is to prefer the resume with a man's name, something like that. But that's just, like, one instance. And the truth is, you know, we experience bias. Anyone who experiences it repeatedly. It's not just, like, a one-time thing. So what I was really trying to figure out was, well, how do all of these momentary, fleeting experiences add up if you look at them over weeks, months, years, or a career? And that was something that I really couldn't find good longitudinal data on. So that's why I decided to create this computer simulation in partnership with a couple of computer scientists.
So how does it work, and what did you find?
Yeah, so the simulation basically is an artificial company that we created called Norm Corp. And it's a really simple company that we set up in computer code, which basically consists of employees, and they do projects either alone or in pairs. And then the projects either succeed or fail, and the successful projects, when an employee has a successful project, they get a boost in this score that we call the promotability score. And then twice a year, the employees with the top scores at every level get promoted. So it's a pretty simple set of rules that are followed in this simulation. But what we did in the simulation was that we then kind of introduced a handful of the most common empirically validated kinds of gender bias that women experience in the workplace. So, for instance, we know there's a lot of empirical data that shows that women's work is slightly devalued in relation to men's. So in our simulation, we had women who succeeded with solo projects get slightly less of a boost in their score than men. There's also a lot of research that shows that when women and men work together, women receive less credit than their male partner. So that was something we also factored into the simulation. We have occasional big projects that come along that have, like, outsized potential for boosts in scores. But as in the real world, in our simulation, women have to have had more past successes in order to be assigned those projects. So there are about a half a dozen different biases that we introduced into the simulation, and then we basically watched what happened over time. And it was pretty alarming to see what happened. I mean, what we found was that you only needed a very, very small amount of bias in order to show really big disparities over 10 years, which was the period of time that we simulated for. So in our simulation, if you only devalue women's work by about 3% with relation to men, over a 10-year set of promotion cycles, you end up with a workplace where the top level is 87% men. So I think one of the most stark findings, I mean, there were a lot of stark findings, but one of them was just how little bias you actually need to have a huge disparity if it's frequently applied. Another really, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, so what you're pointing out is that maybe after the years of headlines of Me Too and a lot of folks maybe thinking, you know, maybe it's big events or toxic managers or big things that are happening to drive out women or drive out other marginalized groups in the workplace, you're actually suggesting and your data has shown that actually it can be an accumulated kind of compounding effect of really small differences over time.
Exactly. And in fact, you know, what we found was that in our simulation, it was actually the small biases that happen frequently that had a much bigger effect on disparities than biases that had a large effect, like our stretch projects we thought were going to have a really big effect. But it was actually the accumulation of really small biases that had the biggest effect. And it's, you know, it's really tricky because one of the things that inspired me to do this simulation was looking at how difficult it is for gender discrimination lawsuits to actually succeed, because juries are looking for that one kind of smoking gun, you know, like just what you said, you know, the hideous manager who does outrageous things, or like a really strong discriminatory policy. But that's not necessarily what's actually affecting most women. What's affecting most women is this kind of slow and steady buildup of small differences that ultimately creates a very large impact over time.
We're talking with Jessica Nordell about her new book, The End of Bias, A Beginning. She's telling us about how unconscious bias affects women in the workplace and ultimately how successful their careers are. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. Right now we're talking with Jessica Nordell, author of The End of Bias, A Beginning. We're talking about unconscious bias and how it affects our workplaces. You can join in, 1-800-642-1234. Have you ever been to an unconscious bias training or anti-harassment training at your workplace? Do you think it was effective? Did you learn anything new? Share with us, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us, ideas@wpr.org. So, Jessica, in your research, what have you found to be effective strategies for identifying and rooting out bias in the workplace?
It's a really good question. I mean, I think a lot of organizations look to trainings as kind of a silver bullet solution. Like, we can, you know, bring in a consultant and do a couple hour training and that will solve the problem. And the challenge with those trainings is that they're rarely evaluated. So we don't necessarily know if they're making things better or worse or not having any effect at all. They also can kind of create the appearance of change without creating actual change. So actual change is challenging. I mean, it requires a lot of work. It requires leaders saying, you know, it's not a matter of if there's bias in our organization, but where and how. And then it takes really systematically looking at all of the places where bias can enter into decision making, from hiring to promotion decisions to the assigning of projects to even questions about, you know, who gets to speak in meetings, who gets various, you know, opportunities thrown their way. And then, you know, sort of systematically trying to ameliorate those. And there are, you know, there are different approaches that do work. Things like standardizing criteria for hiring can be really helpful. Standardizing criteria for making promotion decisions and making those really transparent. Because one thing that often happens in organizations is the, you know, the criteria for getting a promotion are kind of vague or unwritten or kind of amorphous. And therefore, the goalposts can constantly be shifting. And for women or people from other marginalized groups, people from racial or ethnic minorities or people with disabilities, those goalposts can constantly shift. And that can be extremely, you know, frustrating and unfair and lead to a very biased workplace and ultimately, you know, a really unfair workplace. So those are some of the approaches that can work. But, you know, ultimately in my research, I would say what I found to be most essential was the mindset of the leaders. Like if the leaders are really committed and really see diversity and the, you know, welcoming of all people's ideas and potential, if the leader sees those as really essential to the organization, that really makes a big difference.
We're going to go to the phones now. We have a caller for you, Jessica. We have Tim in Madison who's got a question. Good afternoon, Tim.
I guess I have more of a comment than a question.
Sure.
I own several businesses, and usually my role is to start them, and then my wife usually takes over. And I can tell you from firsthand experience the discrimination that happens. For example, we'll be closing a deal. My wife is obviously in charge of all of it. And they'll go around and shake every person's hand that is male and not shake my wife's hand.
Wow.
And it happens all the time. It's unbelievable.
Thanks for sharing with us, Tim, your experience.
That's really interesting, Tim. And I wonder, Tim, if you would have believed that if you hadn't, you know, seen it with your own eyes.
Well, I see it all the time now.
Right.
I know what to look for.
Jessica, is that something that you saw echoed as you talked to people who were trying to grapple with it in their companies, in their workplaces?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is it's challenging because I think, you know, each of us only has our own experience to go from. So if, you know, if Tim were going into those meetings just by himself and people were shaking his hand, he would never know that this could be happening to his wife. But I think it actually does take sort of seeing it sometimes, you know, seeing the difference between how people are treated to make this reality really clear and obvious for people.
So Jessica, what do you recommend companies do as a, I know we only have a moment left with you, but if you had one takeaway for those with decision-making power in companies, what would you recommend?
I would say first, it's really a matter of asking not if, but how and where bias is present. And then once you take a look and identify those places, really systematically look at how it might be possible to standardize decision making and take a little bit more discretion out of the individual and relocate that to a more sort of objective set of standards for making decisions. That's a really good place to start.
Well, that is all the time we have. It went by so fast. Thank you so much, Jessica, for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
We've been speaking with science journalist Jessica Nordell. Her new book is called The End of Bias, A Beginning. Now, Wisconsin law enforcement agencies have had difficulty recruiting officers for years. The national reckoning last year over racial justice and calls for police reform only added to agencies' struggles. As Danielle Kading reports, the pandemic, rising violence, and intense scrutiny of police have made it more challenging to attract and keep officers.
Lauren Phillips remembers watching with her police academy classmates in Eau Claire this past spring as they waited for a verdict in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. She says what Chauvin did was wrong and they wanted justice to be served.
Everyone was anxious. Everyone was hoping that the right thing would come about. But at the same time, we're all sitting there like, what happens if this goes south? We were still recruits in the academy, but we still wore shirts that said, like, CBTC law enforcement.
Phillips and fellow students would change their shirts or grab a jacket before going out in public. Officers have faced intense outrage and criticism since Chauvin murdered George Floyd last May, igniting worldwide protests calling for police accountability. The negative attitudes toward police didn't sway Phillips. Now on patrol for Superior Police, she wants to bring more respect to law enforcement.
And they will remember you, and they will remember the things that you do. So it's one of those things to take into... It's just one of those things to be cognizant of when you are out in the community.
But it's getting harder to attract people like Phillips. A national survey of nearly 200 police departments found hiring dropped, while retirements rose 45% and resignations climbed by 18% from April of last year to this spring. Executive Director Jim Palmer with the Wisconsin Professional Police Association says the pandemic and intense scrutiny have made it more challenging to draw and keep officers.
There are more options for younger people today that pay better and don't require them to put their lives and their personal safety at risk and that don't carry the significant enhanced scrutiny.
Massive protests unfolded in Milwaukee and Madison last year with calls to defund police. In Milwaukee, retirements among Milwaukee police spiked nearly 40% last year, with 131 officers calling it a career. In the last 5 years, more than 500 Milwaukee cops have retired. In an interview with the city's Fire and Police Commission, acting Milwaukee Police Chief Jeffrey Norman says the loss of officers is a challenge.
And so we need to have, again, something that we have not had in a long time. A consistency of a transition of when those particular type of individuals move on, are we able to continue to lift without having a blip on the radar?
Under the next budget, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett is proposing to use COVID-19 stimulus funds to train 195 new officers next year.
Overall, the total strength of the department will be on average 1,657, not quite keeping pace with retirements.
In Madison, the number of applicants for this year's recruit class dropped by nearly 44%. The Police Association's Palmer thinks investment in community policing is crucial to building trust between officers and communities they serve. Megan Stroshein is an associate professor of criminology and law studies at Marquette University. She says more community policing would be a step in the right direction.
If we can improve the relationship between the police and the public, policing will become a more attractive position.
But Marquesa Tucker-Harris with the African American Roundtable says Milwaukee police have been talking about community policing for a long time, and she doesn't see it making a difference. She's been pushing for cuts to police budgets. She says taxpayer money should be shifted away from law enforcement to support housing assistance and other programs to address the root causes of poverty and violence.
What we do know is what we've been doing isn't working. And we can't continue to waste money. We can't continue to allow lives to continue to be destroyed and lost.
The number of homicides had been falling in recent years across Milwaukee, but killing spiked during the pandemic last year with a record 190 homicides. The city is on track to break that record this year as police staffing in Milwaukee hits a record 20-year low. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And I'm Molly Stentz. You're listening to Central Time.